a joy to be around the Word of God. We continue our fellowship as we hear His Word and we respond in our hearts to His Word. You know, the Christian subculture in America has its practices, has its forms and figures and ways of doing things. You should know you're kind of part of it. People can see certain things going on and they say, ah, that guy must be a Christian because of maybe something he wears or does. Christians go to church, they listen to Christian radio, they download Christian apps, they have fun and food and fellowship. They put up plaques on their walls, maybe a fish on a car, a rock and roll t-shirt maybe. What do you think, Hota? Nice rock and roll t-shirt. And we try to avoid certain things, drunken parties, gambling, porn shops. We have reasons for these kinds of things. We're distinct. We're a little bit different than the world we're supposed to be. I think there's nothing inherently wrong with having a subculture. We have it. I would expect, anyone would expect, if you have a subculture, they have something about that subculture that walks and quacks a little bit differently than the other subcultures. The problem is not with those kinds of externals. The problem is when the internals of our religion are absent, but the externals are there. When Christianity is worn on the outside and not lived on the inside. This was a concern. It led Jesus to denounce very strongly the Pharisees. It led the prophets of Israel to tell the Israelites to stop their forms of religion and bring them no more until their hearts were right. Don't bring me all the songs when you're practicing a lack of justice throughout the week. It also is a concern which led James to write the two verses that are our text today. The end of chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. I'm going to read it for you. Please open there to James 1. Follow along. Consider what God would say to you this day. James writes, "If anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world." Today is a corrective message. It's instruction, but it has correction as its aim. It's based on a self-thought. You see it there in verse 26. If anyone thinks himself to be religious. Now, sometimes we think other people are religious. Ah, there's somebody who's religious. But this is when you think of yourself as religious. There are people like that. You might be one of them. There are many people in the world that think that they're religious. There are all kinds of religions in the world. And they may practice their religion and think, I'm a religious person. I'm dedicated to my religion. They think themselves to be religious. Religious is the word thraiskos, a word that's used only here in the entire New Testament. Isn't that interesting? Although the related word is used in verse 27, religion. This term, religious, ever wonder what that means? What does it mean, you're religious? This term refers to the relationship with a deity and to mostly the displays that and the practices that go along with a religion. Josephus used this very term for all of the Jewish ceremonies that they carried on in the temple. They did these ceremonies, and so they were religious. Many religions, many different kinds of practices. If you practice one religion, there are certain things that go with that, and you see someone do that, and you say, oh, they're religious and they're Buddhist. Or you see someone else, you know, a month of fasting, which is really not a month of fasting, and you say, oh, they must be Muslim. So there are the practices that go along with that. Jesus participated in religious things. Jesus was religious. Jesus thought of himself as religious. Jesus went to the temple and participated in the feasts and did the various things that were required of him. Jesus was a religious man. For many people, these religious activities would include things like attending worship services, making sacrifices, participating in a fast of some kind, singing certain kinds of songs. There's always liturgy that are in different kinds of religions. Saying prayers, there's a religious thing. Lighting candles, you know. maybe even making pilgrimages. In their religion, they need to go and travel somewhere, see something. Maybe abstaining from certain kinds of foods or drinks. The Romans were trying to figure out what all the fuss was that was following the Apostle Paul wherever he went and preached from city to city. And in Acts 25:19, it says that they saw this as a disagreement with Paul about their own religion. They didn't want to get involved in that. It's some disagreement about a religion. They kind of looked at that. There's a religion that's being practiced. They're squabbling about a religion. What does this have to do with us? Oh, and Jesus and Paul was asserting that there was some man that was alive from the dead. And they were arguing about this and getting angry. That's a religious squabble. Leave it alone. Acts 26:5, the Apostle Paul said he was raised a Pharisee according to the strictest sect of our religion. So he was religious times four. You know, he was the strictest sect. He was like, some are all out in their religion. That was him. You know, religion is still a very powerful force in the world. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, the atheists are always talking, and they're really not ever, they're always a very small minority because atheism never proves anything. Atheism is a non-explanation. You know, how did the universe get here? From nothing. I mean, there's no intellectual basis for atheism. They just don't like to admit that because you press them with a few questions. They have no answers at all. That's why people are inherently religious. They are that way because they know there has to be something that explains all of this. You went to Jerusalem today, and we went a few years ago. The whole city, the old Jerusalem, the whole place is religious. It just smells of religion. I mean, everything that everybody's wearing, they're trying to outdo one another. There's the holy sites and how they keep the holy sites, the banners that they put up, what they wear, the songs, the yarmulkes, everything. It's just all religious. There's the Jews doing their religious thing, and some of them are more so than others. There's the Catholics, and they have their little niche. The Muslims have their little, the Armenians have their little thing going. Everybody's got their thing going, you know, except the evangelicals. They don't have too much of a display there in old Jerusalem. But they're very, very religious. You see the signs everywhere. So James is talking to people who think they're religious. And there's lots of those kind of people in the world. Lots of them. And they practice their religion. They know there's a God of some kind. They know there's some metaphysical something out there. They get that. They're beyond the silliness of atheism. They think that their religion is true. And by the way, this person's not a hypocrite, not a conscious hypocrite, that is. You know, they really do think that they are practicing their religion. They think they're religious. Now, maybe they were raised by their parents to be religious and they haven't thought it all through that much. Maybe they're part of some kind of a subculture and it's a very religious subculture and they just kind of grab onto that. Some of you kids are raised up in this church and you're raised in a religious environment and you need to think through, okay, so why, you know, what am I doing here with my religion? Sometimes they've met somebody and they've converted over to a religion and someone was persuasive and they've joined that religion. But here is the main point. Thinking yourself to be religious is not enough. True? It's not enough. There must be some genuine, heartfelt practice of a religion. True religion centers on the heart. It comes from the mind. It comes from the whole being. Otherwise, it becomes a show. It becomes a farce. True religion results in obeying what God's law is. Of liberty says. So what James writes here, very interestingly, is true religion is revealed in three tests, and that's our little outline. There are three tests, and you can use this to test yourself. You can use this to develop your own discernment about who really has true religion. But here are the tests. First, controlling the tongue. Second, helping the helpless. And third, keeping yourself unstained by the world. Three tests. If your religion is a true religion. Now, I got to say right from the very beginning that James is not trying to say these are the only three indications of true religion, okay? Douglas Moo in his commentary says, we would badly misunderstand these verses were we to think that James is intending to summarize here all that true worship of God should involve. Obviously, it does not. John Calvin said, James does not define generally what religion is, but reminds us that religion without the things he mentions is nothing. So these are three good tests. One more quote for you. Dan McCartney says, "This verse is not meant as an exhaustive list of what pleases God. Rather, it describes by personal example the behavior patterns exhibited by a person whose character is being shaped by true religion. That is, genuine faith." Do you have genuine faith? Is your faith genuine? And are you saved because the faith that you have is a genuine faith? Well, here's three tests that kind of unpack that and reveal that, because we have a problem, and that problem is we deceive ourselves a lot. And this verse is just like it's a wonderful opening for you to be able to see inside of you and say, do I really have true religion, or is it kind of stuck on the outside and hasn't come to the inside? Okay, you with me? That's what we're doing here. First, controlling the tongue. Oh my. Here we go. Verse 26. So he says he's religious, but he does not, what? Bridle his tongue. So that means he deceives his own heart. We'll stop right there. This introduces a theme that James is going to write about in much greater detail as he gets into the letter more. When we get to chapter 3, almost the whole chapter is about the tongue. So we'll save a lot of the ammunition for there. We have to talk about our tongue. As believers, we need to talk about our tongue. But here he's basically saying, if there isn't some kind of basic bridling or control of your tongue, if you can't find that in your life, then your religion is not a true religion. And it's interesting, he chooses bridling. I mean, he brings up the image of the horse, right? The harness on the horse at the mouth. Why? So he can be turned wherever he needs to go. It's a big animal. Or he can be pulled to stop, right? It's kind of hard to stop a horse. Horse is a massive animal. A horse has a load of strength. There's a reason why even 100 years after we developed the automobile, we're still talking about how much horsepower it has inside of it, right? You have to pull the horse this way or that way. Can you imagine a 700, 800, 900-pound horse galloping full speed at you or at a crowd of people? They'd all get out of the way, right? What destruction a horse like that could give. That horse needs to be controlled. The horse is controlled by the bridle. What about us? The tongue is much smaller, but the tongue can create all kinds of damage, can it not? Have you ever been hurt by someone else's tongue? Don't even answer that. Some of your deepest wounds are because of what other people said to you, and one of those moments they didn't think very much, or they thought too much and they wanted to harm you. You know the destructive power of the tongue. The tongue can be spoken and someone could go out and kill themselves. The tongue can be spoken and it can break apart a relationship forever. The tongue can be spoken, speaking out something like that, and can just ruin somebody else's career with slander, right? The tongue can be damaging. We are reminded over and over and over again, keep a tight rein on your tongue. If you're a religious person, if you're a Christian, you need to bridle your own tongue. Don't worry about someone else's tongue. Work on your tongue. Many of the Proverbs just say that. I'm going to read some of them for you. Proverbs 12:18. There's one who speaks rashly. And then it says this, like the thrusts of a sword. You know, gotcha. And that's what it is. But the tongue of the wise brings healing. Does your tongue hurt or does your tongue heal? Proverbs 15:4, a soothing tongue is a tree of life, but perversion in it crushes the spirit. Man, that's what a tongue can do. Proverbs 18:21, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. Proverbs 21:23, he who guards his mouth and his tongue guards his soul from trouble. A lot of times we have trouble in our lives because we didn't guard our tongue. And I put myself in that category. I say something, I'm like, nah, I got a whole bunch of problems. I shouldn't have said that. If I hadn't said that, I wouldn't have all these troubles, but I said it, so now I have the troubles, no taking it back. I got to deal with the trouble and I got to work all the way through that. How much trouble we would avoid if we just held on to our tongues. The north wind brings forth rain and a backbiting tongue and angry countenance. Proverbs 25:23. Proverbs 26:28. A lying tongue hates those it crushes and a flattering mouth works ruin. All kinds of ways the tongue can hurt. It flatters, it lies, it deceives, it boasts, it slanders. All those things. The tongue can be vitriolic, hateful, arrogant, slanderous, boisterous, cunning, and all those things hurt. Did you know that self-control was one of the list of the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5:23? Having control over what you say. Paul wrote in Ephesians 4:29, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for what? for edification, for building up. Your tongue should always be about how can I help other people be built up. Sometimes you need to correct them in order to build them up, but you have to do that in humility. You have to do that with patience and gentleness, so it's obvious you're not trying to put them down and put yourself up. If you're correcting someone, it's because you're trying to correct them and help them. You're on their side. So your spirit needs to show you're on their side. Don't correct them and say, well, I'm correcting someone because that's what I do. I correct people. Yeah, but you sound like you're hurting them. You know? Well, that's my gift. Well, keep that gift to yourself. Make sure you're edifying. Make sure you're building up. If you have to correct, look to yourself and then be constructive in the way that you correct someone else. We need correction, but we need godly correctors in the church. Be edifying. Only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment. How do you build someone else up? Think what their need is. If they're having trouble in some area in their spirit and you've discerned that, then help them with that. Talk to them gently. If they misunderstand you, tell them I think you've misunderstood me. I'm here to help. When your feelings settle down, I'll come back and help. And make sure your tongue is building up. Control your tongue. Sometimes the tongue has to say nothing, wait for the opportune moment, and then say something. So let's go back to this person who thinks he's religious. He thinks he's religious, but he doesn't bridle his tongue. What is the conclusion? He has deceived his own what? Heart. The tongue is that important. If you can't bridle the tongue, whatever you think you are is not true. And I'm sorry, but that's what it says. It says if you can't bridle your tongue, your religion's not true. You may have thought it's true. You may have been going to church services for a long time, but it hasn't gotten on the inside of you yet. Man, you need to wake up, because this is true. You deceive your own heart. See, really, we're talking about the heart here. You're deceiving your own heart, because you see what comes out of the tongue reveals the heart, right? Jesus said that. It's not what you eat that defiles you. And he was letting the Jewish people know. It's not what you eat that defiles you. It's not what goes into your mouth that defiles you. It's what comes out of your mouth that defiles you. You speak from your mind. You know, people say, I speak my mind. That's right. You speak your mind and your mind is ugly. The heart is another word for mind. It's not feelings. It's thinking. So you're speaking your heart. You're speaking from what comes in the center of you and you're speaking it. And that reveals your heart. And so if it's not bridled and all this ugly stuff comes out, that lets you know there's no religion on the inside. So Jesus taught that. That was in Matthew 15, by the way. So if a man comes to church, he sings some beautiful songs this morning, right? Grace, grace, you know, just beautiful songs. He goes home and he treats his wife poorly. Yeah, never do this. Yeah, you're no good with that. Yells at the kids. How many times I got to tell you? Cusses at the co-workers. Cuts down his fellow believers. I can't believe so-and-so did such and such a church. Can you believe that? Then his religion is it's worthless. It's not a true religion. It's phony. Okay. You know, someone comes to church and they're quoting Bible verses. Very impressive. Look at all those Bible verses he can quote. Wow. He must memorize a lot of verses. Even better, look at the theologians he quotes. Oh, man. He's got this quote, that quote. Posts them on Facebook. Twitters them out. Tweets them out. What's the word? I don't know. Pumping them out. Great theologians. Names is Cat Calvin, even. I mean, he's a religious guy. The dog is Knox. Religious guy. But he's rude to other people. You know, the Christians that have the bumper stickers, three or four of them on there. Jesus is Lord. Blah, blah, blah. And then they're as rude as all get out. Bad testimony. You know, you put a fish on the back of your car, you better drive better, by the way. That's why I don't put one on mine. No, I'm just kidding. Holy Spirit says the man's religion is worthless. Write him off. He professes to be something, but it's not true. He presents himself as pursuing God, but you can be discerning about him or, sadly, maybe about you, that that's not true. Now, keep in mind, there's nothing wrong with being religious. There was a time in my life where I went around telling people, look, I'm not religious, I just love the Lord. Well, I didn't understand that religion actually is a good thing. Religion is directed towards God. It's the perversion of religion that's the problem. You know, you can't actually love the Lord Jesus if you're not religious, because that would mean then you're not going to church and you're not supporting the church and you're not praying and you're not listening to his word. And guess what? Those are all religious things. So obviously Jesus was religious. His disciples were religious. So you need to be religious. So the religious part is fine, just not bare and empty religion. Religion alone doesn't cut it with God. Now, you grow up in the church, and listen to this, children. You grow up in the church, you know, and you've been coming, singing. You've been doing. You might even be part of the youth ministry. Maybe you're older now. You're still coming, but you think you're a Christian because you're here, and maybe even because you're baptized. The water doesn't really do anything to you, right? None of that stuff means you're a Christian. None of that stuff means you have the religion inside of you. Jesus has to be invited all the way in. You know, sometimes people want a little bit of religion. They want, you know, Jesus is a nice idea. What a sweet thing, Jesus. To have a little bit of Jesus in your life, a little bit of blessing, a little bit of, that's nice. That's nice. But he doesn't want to come in on the side. He wants to come in, take over. That's the thing about the Lord is he's actually the Lord. You know what the Lord does? He commands you what to do. If you don't invite him in that way, you haven't invited him in because that's who he is. People say, do you have to obey Jesus as Lord to be saved? Well, that's what believing in Jesus as Lord means. If you'll confess with your mouth Jesus as Lord, believe in your heart God raised him from the dead, you'll be saved. What does it mean to confess Jesus as Lord? Well, Jesus answered it. He said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and don't do the things I say? Imagine being the Lord, being called Lord, Lord. You give out a command and people just don't obey it. Why do you call me Lord, Lord? That's what the word means. It means master, master. King, king. It means when you confess Jesus as your Lord, it means now you're ready to follow him. Now you're gonna, your life's going to change. And that has to affect the tongue, wouldn't you agree? Because it affects the heart, right? So if it affects the heart, then it has to affect the language, the mouth. You got it. And if it hasn't, then all the other religious words, all the other paraphernalia, ignore it. It's a smokescreen. All right, next test. Helping the helpless. Verse 27, look at it. Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress. This introduces also another topic that James is going to expand upon later. He's going to talk about this in chapter 2, a faith that will help others, a faith that looks out for those who are weaker or poor. It's interesting, he's introducing these three themes as tests here, and when we get into chapter 2, we're going to see one theme. We get into chapter 3, we'll see another theme, and chapter 4, we'll see another theme. But this mercy and love is very important here, and he brings it up. He says true religion, and he calls it pure and undefiled religion. And by the way, those two words are basically saying the same thing. Pure is sort of the positive side. Undefiled is the negative side. You're pure and undefiled. They work together. What is pure is undefiled. What is undefiled is pure. You know, if you were looking for a nice glass of water and you said it was pure, that would mean it would be undefiled, right? If you said it's undefiled, it'd be pure. There's no dirt in it, there's no poison in it, there's no contaminations in it. That's what it is. Pure and undefiled religion means, well, it means that it's not defiled by things that he doesn't specify here, but we could fill in the blank, couldn't it? Pure and undefiled religion defiled by what? Well, if you're helping the orphans and the widows? That means that you're not all about yourself. We're going to talk about the orphans and widows in a minute. They're very helpless. They can't help you back. So if you're taking time to give your time, your money, your connection, reputation with helping those who are kind of really low down in society and can't help you back, then there's a lot of things that are true about you. We can deduce from that you don't have a love of money. So that would mean love of money would defile your religion, I think, right? And that's 1 Timothy 6. The love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. Money is not the evil. It's the love of money that's evil. Love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pang. That's 1 Timothy 6. You would not have a love of selfish displays. You'd not be thinking, I can't wait to get past my obligations because then I'm going to run out and I'm going to go. What's that blank in your life? Video games? Going to the sports game? Whatever that is that you want to get to that thing. Get past church, get past work, get past all these obligations. Please, I just want to get to the, and whatever fills your mind, like I just want to get to that spot, and that fills your mind too much, that's defiling your religion, see? A love of fame, maybe? Some selfish thing? or some fame or some money or something, something for you, something about your reputation maybe that defiles your religion. No, we want to have pure and undefiled religion. And then it says, in the sight of God our Father. Isn't it interesting he calls him Father here, because he's going to talk about the orphans and widows, and he's a father to the fatherless, and he takes care of the widows, right? So I'm practicing my religion before God the Father. Oh yeah, you have to practice religion before God. That's one of the mistakes someone who's into religion has. They think they're practicing the religion before other people. That's why they're all religious on Sundays, but not Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Because they're practicing their religion for the sake of what other people think of them. But this says, no, the good religion is in the sight of God and God the Father. When does he look at me? All the time. He looks at me all the time. The thing about him is he doesn't just look at me, he looks inside of me. He probes my mind. He searches my heart. So how do I have pure and undefiled religion in the sight of God, who's my Father? He's our Father. The answer is, well, it needs to be pure from the heart. And it needs to result in taking care of the helpless. It needs to be not about you, but about others. If you've tasted of the goodness of God, if you've tasted of the mercy of God, if you've tasted of the love of God, if you've experienced the grace of God in your life, if that's true of you, then it translates into, I'm going to care for somebody else. Look, there's somebody in need. Oh, that's going to mess up my schedule because, see, I had a wonderful afternoon planned for myself. But this person's in need. That's pure and undefiled religion, you see. By the way, God is not our mother. Did you get that? Did you look in there? Please, next time someone says God is mother, just take him right here. He's Father. So how do you know he's Father? Because he said he was. You know, if I was a father, walked in the store, and I said I'm Father, someone called me a mother, I'd be kind of upset. Nothing wrong with being a mother. Being a mother is a fine thing. Being a mother is a wonderful thing. I'm not a mother. I'm a father. God's a father. He calls himself Father. These translations of the Bible and these people going around saying God is mother also. No, he's Father. That's what he said. He's the originator. He's the creator. He's the recreator in Christ. We get our life from his Son. And his Son is like the Father. His Son reveals the Father. Your heavenly dad is watching you this week. He wants to know if you're practicing pure and undefiled religion. How can I do that? Visit orphans and widows in their distress. There it is. There's the target. That's the bullseye to aim at. Visit the widows and orphans in their distress. Not when they're having it good, but when they are in their distress. In the sphere of all the pressure that there is in being an orphan and a widow, when it's very hard for them, when they can't give you anything back, when all they're going to do is take your time and your money, visit them. And visit them does not mean have a gregarious chat with them. Visit them, the very implication of the word in Greek is that you're coming ready to help them in some way. Who are the orphans? You know who orphans are. They don't have any parents. They're deprived of their parents by death or abandonment. They can't fend for themselves. Often they can't feed themselves. They don't have a guardian. No one's looking after them. They're exposed to elements. Many of them die. Widows just means a woman who was married lost her husband to death. Widows in that culture are not usually able to care for themselves. Couldn't go out and get a job. There was no job for women outside of the home except for the occupation called prostitution. You want to go do that. Widows could go from having a very secure economic situation to almost instant insecurity. They're in distress. A complete change of lifestyle. James says widows and orphans need to be visited in their distress. Can you imagine what distress there is economically, health-wise? Concern about safety and protection for the orphans and the widows. So when you go to visit them, come with something in hand. Come carrying something. Here, I heard that you need this. And I also brought this along. You know, and I gave it a little bit of thought, and I thought you might need this. Do you need this? I've come ready to help. By the way, who's going to fix the lock on your back door? And what other needs do you have? Can we get something for you? You come ready to visit them. Why did James pick on this thing to show true religion? I'll tell you why. Because this is a display of love, mercy. See, if you have true faith in Christ, it's going to work its way into your life, into the fabric of the way you think, so that now you want to start loving other people. No, I'm not talking about loving your friends. They've always been easy. They're your friends, you like them, you party with them, you do things, you invite them over. Loving the people who are not your friends, who are not like you, who you don't necessarily enjoy, but you love them because they have needs. Faith, Paul says, needs to work itself through love. In fact, you look at all the writers of the New Testament, they say, if you want to try to figure out if someone has real faith in Jesus Christ, look to see if there's love there. Is the root of the tree good? I can't see it. It's down beneath the ground. It's in the dirt. You know, I was out digging roots up the other day. It's hard digging up roots. I was sweating away. I was having a good time, though. I just like that, just being outside in the mud and the dirt and all of that. But you don't know what's going on with the roots, so you dig down in there, and you're like, wow, look at all those roots. A lot of roots down there. But if you want to know if the root is good, you look for the fruit on the tree. Oh, that's a good fruit. Must be a good root. That's what it is with you. If your faith is good, if your faith is real, if your faith in Jesus has landed in the right spot, they're going to look at the fruit. What's the fruit? Love. Love for other people. And where's the best way of testing whether or not you have love? If you love those that can't give anything back to you. 1 John 3. Whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Can't. Just a real practical way of evaluating that theology. That theology says if you have true faith, you're going to have love. And I know that love will grow. I'm not talking about being an instant saint here. But there should be something in you that's saying, I want to give. I want to help. I want to do this. I just learned to love this person. And I know 3 years ago, I never would have loved them like that. That's what should be happening. Paul said faith works through love. Peter said, since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. James says love is the royal law in chapter 2. Jesus put it this way in Luke 14. It says he went out and said to the one who had invited him, he was invited to something, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives. Now, he didn't mean never do that. Or rich neighbors. Otherwise, they may also invite you in return, and that will be your repayment. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, since they do not have the means to repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Don't you love that? The resurrection of the righteous is coming. I'm going to be repaid. Are you going to be paid anything at the resurrection of the righteous? You got to start making some investments now, see? Who are the distressed in our society? This is a harder question because government has taken over so much now of what used to be the role of the church and families. Government takes over more and more and more, and people say that's a good thing, and they're going to care for the poor, and there's this protection, and that really was never the design for government that God had from the beginning. It was really the role of the church, and it was the role of the people. It was the role of the families to get out there and meet needs. And now you look around and you're like, well, who's poor? We have a poverty level here in America. It's not really that poor when you compare it. There's millions of people that are in the poverty level. You put them overseas and be like, man, you have a lot. You have a lot. It's kind of hard to figure out who are the real poor in our society. Obviously, in some countries, developing countries, poorer countries, there's some real poverty there. That would be some of the ones that need our input. Maybe some of them are the homeless. Some people are homeless because of bad habits. Some people are homeless because of bad things that have happened to them. And it takes sometimes discernment to know what's going on. You know, some people are locked up in prison because they deserve to be locked up in prison, right? Orphans and widows, he pulls them out because they didn't deserve that. They didn't deserve mom and daddy to die on them. The husband just, you know, went and died on them. Now what? You know? Then there was no safety net for them there. Maybe the handicapped in our society. Maybe in some cases, the homeless. We have a mercy ministry we began here. Thomas Rhodes is leading that. Join him. Help him. He's trying to find those, you know, single parents maybe. Single mothers have several kids. They need some help. Get out there. Some of them are not teachable. Maybe some of them made some bad mistakes, but we want to have mercy to them. We want to reach out. We want to care for them. Do you have a neighbor that has needs? Looks like they have real needs. And maybe they did make some bad decisions, and maybe they're suffering from that. And maybe they've learned a little bit of a lesson there. You can still go and help them, right? They're still suffering. Maybe there's someone in church. We have a Helping Hands Fund here, a benevolence fund, we call it. You can donate to that so that folks in the church can be cared for. You look for them. You open your eyes, inner city ministry, you help them out, and help the church too, please, because you see, if we had more of you volunteering your time, then we could start more ministries to help the poor. We just need your time. We need people to coordinate and lead and do that. When you have a heart for the needy, your wallet comes out of your pocket. It comes in your hand. You open it up and you find something in there and you make a payment. That's what happens. You open your heart and you open your wallet. You open your heart and you open your pocketbook. That's how it works, okay? You open up your heart and you write a check. And so that's how it is. And then you give time. You don't say you don't have time. You make time. And you find who you can care for. So that's the second test. We come to the third and last test. And that is keeping yourself unstained by the world. Again, this is going to jump to chapter 4. And James is going to talk all about worldliness and the love of the world there and how incompatible that is with God. We're going to get a little bit of a sneak preview to that right here. And he says, keep yourself unstained by the world. In other words, don't let, it's kind of the clothing analogy. You have some nice threads on you. Got some nice clothes on you. You don't want to go with your nice clothes and go do a dirty job right now, right? So you are in a world that's dirty, is the point. You know, the world is the cosmos. Sometimes the word world refers to the planet. More often it refers to the world of humanity, the people in the world. But here he's talking about it as the wickedness of the world. Men in their sin kind of organized together, even with evil spirits that work in that midst. The world like that. Keep yourself unstained from that. It's dirty in a world. My goodness, there's so much filth out there. I was talking to someone the other day. I said, you know, I get 1 hour a week to tell you guys how to think and how to live. Just 1 hour. That's all I get. And then you go out there and you listen to the filth on the radio. You watch the filth on TV and you don't turn it off soon enough. And you listen to the garbage other people are saying and you don't turn your ears enough. And you get filth and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And you got to keep yourself as you minister in this world, as you outreach in this world, you have to keep that filth off your garments. What does that mean? That means you don't want even a little bit of that filth on your nice garments. You're clothed by Christ. You're supposed to look different. Don't let that filth on you. You have to find a way to walk among them and be different. And I don't mean just different. Brothers and sisters, we are not postmodern. We're not different. Well, that's your way of doing things, and this is my way of doing things. No, we're better. Say that to someone one time. Oh, you are so arrogant. We are better. We live a better lifestyle than them. Theirs is not equal to ours. Theirs is nowhere equal to ours at all. When people say, oh, you're bright. Of course we're bragging. Of course it's better. It's better to have moral purity than to have the filth out there. Of course it is. Do any of you think it's not? They think the same thing when they find someone more wicked than themselves. They judge them. Because they know. They just don't like the fact that yours is higher than theirs. Of course it's a better lifestyle. That's why they need to be converted. That's why they need to be saved. You're supposed to live better than them. You're supposed to be the example. You're supposed to be the holy one among them, as they will mock, but you need to be. But Pastor, that sounds like I'm boasting. No, when they look at the good works that are in your life, then you give glory to who? To Christ. See, I used to be like you, and he saved me. He dredged me up. And he saved me. He washed me and cleansed me. And you can be like me too. If you weren't different and you weren't better, what's the point of becoming a Christian? Don't buy into that lie from Satan, please. Spiritually, we are to live among them. Remember, we have to live in the world, but not be what? Of the world. But we don't want to imitate their styles. Why would we want to imitate their styles? Their styles come from their heart. We don't want to imitate their attitudes. Why would we want to have their attitudes? We have a better attitude. We read the Beatitudes, and those are our attitudes, God willing. What about their humor? Their humor shouldn't be your humor. If you love their humor, you don't love God. Their sexy dress, why? Girls, why? Why do you imitate their sexy dress? What are you dressing for? Their attitudes towards sports. You know, sometimes I make fun like I'm a fanatic with sports. In my heart, I'm really not, you know. But then you see someone who's really a fanatic, and you're like, I can't joke around this person. This person's idol is sports. It can be many other things. They're complaining at work. Oh, my, the constant complaining at work. Do you join it? the little humor around the water cooler. When you become a Christian, you're now better. We're to live in the world. Be cautious as we move among them. They fling their dirt all the time. Don't let it land on you. You don't want to have evil like them. I mean, this is strong stuff we're going to get to. James 4:4, he says, "You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world," and I'll bet some of you wish that you were a friend of the world. I'll bet in your heart you really wish the unbelievers in your life would really, really like you and include you. And they don't. If you want to be a friend of the world, you make yourself an enemy of God. God has taken his side, and it's his side. And he says, step over onto my side. I'm going to destroy the world. I mean, how would you be able to hang out in Noah's Ark and also be outside of Noah's Ark at the same time back in the ancient days? How are you going to do that, right? Get in the boat and be saved, or stay outside and be drowned. Make a choice. That's the choice before people. Oh, but the world has so many things to offer. Things to offer that are quickly passing away and don't satisfy. Make a choice. 1 John 2, do not love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, finish it for me. The love of the Father is not in them. Can't mix the loves. Can't. If you think you're mixing the loves, you're not. You're loving one or the other. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes. See, some are battling with sins of the flesh. Some are battling with sins of the eyes. And then for those that have all the self-control, it nails you next, the boastful pride of life. God is opposed to proud people. It says that in the Bible. To remain unspotted, you are not to isolate yourself from unbelievers. We're not monks. We're not more godly because we don't meet an unbeliever all week long. 1 Corinthians 5:9, Paul says, I wrote you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. Now he clarifies. I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world, for then you would have to go out of the world. You're here in a world. You're supposed to be around unbelievers. You're just not supposed to let them rub off on you, right? Listen, brothers and sisters, Christianity takes courage. It takes courage. Are you going to stand up and be courageous? And by the way, don't accept the classifications and terminology of the world around you. Boy, the media just pushes this on us over and over and over again. You cannot adopt their language. When you start adopting their language, you've already had your first step into conforming to the way they are. You must purposefully choose to disagree and use different language. What do I mean? It's not a choice. It's the murder of a baby. You with me? It is the murder of a human being. It is murder. That is a real human being in there. Science says so. More importantly, God says so. It's not being gay. It's sexual perversion. We shouldn't even be using that terminology. It's not alcoholism. It's drunkenness. It's not an affair. Doesn't that sound nice? Like you're going to the fair. I'm going to have an affair. I'm going to the fair. It's fun. We'll go on the little twirly thing and we'll have an affair. And there are all kinds of other terms that are used now. I can't even use them from the pulpit. What is it? It's treachery. It's breaking a commandment. It's breaking a vow that you made. It's unfaithfulness. It's lying. It's not low self-esteem. Quit saying it. It's wallowing in self-pity. It's a proud person wishing they were better than they were. And other people would recognize them that way, and they're not, and so they're wallowing in their self-pity, and they have low self-esteem. No, it's pride. Pride that's hurting. That's what it is. It's not coming out. It's wallowing in shame. It's not colorful language. It's dirty words. You get the idea? Call it what it is. As soon as you start adopting their labels, you're already halfway thinking like that. If you want to please God, you'll be very concerned with not being stained by the world. I hope and pray you'll think about this a little bit. If your Christianity is true, you're going to want to be different from those in the world. You are going to look forward to being different. You don't want to be like them. You look at them and you pity them. You know where they're headed. You see what they're doing and you can see through it. Even their moments of joy and happiness and what they're doing, you see through it. You know the conflict that's there. You know the lack of peace that's there. You've been down that road. You've been there, done that. It's not what it claims to be. Now you want to save them from it because you have much better discernment now. And you know where real joy is. You know where real peace is. Can I ask you something? Are you happy to be a Christian? Are you inside your heart joyful to be a Christian? If you are, then don't go tasting the poison of the world. You won't, right? I got so much more and I got no more time. And by the way, some of you are texting stuff. My fingers don't even move that fast. And you're using abbreviations that if we were to write out what those abbreviations were and bring them into church, I think you would blush. What do your little initials in there mean? Of course, the church is willing to forgive all these sins because we're all sinners. That's not the point. We're all forgiven. We're all washed. We're all willing to forgive. You have a sin, you need to come forward, talk to me or one of the leaders today. You can be saved this day. You can be washed and cleansed. Nothing special about us compared to you. You got some really bad hidden things you want to just spill out, then spill them out. But the key is if you're going to put your faith in Christ or not, because he'll wash you clean entirely. I was asked this past week, is love more important than truth? And I said, no. You can't even have love without truth. It wouldn't even be love. Truth and holiness is the foundation on which love rests. When truth and holiness crumble, love is lost. It turns into lust. It turns into a perverted form of love. I was once sitting in a class in a church years ago, and the pastor who led the class said, you know, the church needs to be a lot more like the local bar. Down there at the local bar, they can go down there, they can confess all their sins, and nobody judges them. And they feel comfortable there. So I was in the class. I raised my hand. I said, but at the local bar, they don't care if you live holy or not. In the church, we care very much whether or not we live holy. Makes it trickier. We have to have both mercy and a passion for holiness as well. For in holiness is blessing. So I don't think our goal is the same as the local bar. It's just me. But I think maybe we have a different calling. We have to be a place that washes sinners off and doesn't say, it's okay that you continue to sin. And I know that makes some people uncomfortable, but it won't make you uncomfortable if you really want forgiveness and you really want cleansing. All right, back to the conclusion. So what happens to the one who doesn't bridle his tongue, doesn't care for the helpless, and doesn't keep himself unstained by the world? The answer was already given. Verse 26, this man's religion is worthless. What does that mean? Vain, empty, of no use. It's a word that's used for idolatry. It's a vain thing. Acts 14:15 uses that. It's futile. There's a popular brand of jeans in a store that's called True Religion. You seen it? True Religion. I don't know what made them think that jeans would be True Religion. I haven't quite figured that one out. Whatever it is, I know it's wrong. There's a lot of religion out there that's not true. Here's the question for you. When you walk around, you talk to people, you go to work, is your religion going to be true? Because I'm going to tell you right now, the people out there need to see someone who's true, with true religion. And if it is, then you know that God's working on your mouth. And you know that you need to have a love towards those who are hurting and help them. And you know there's a lot of filth all around in the world. And it better be your goal to stay free and clean from that junk. And it may just start with something you have in your house right now and you need to get out of your house. Like some program, some video, something like that. It might be more restrictions you need on your laptop. Maybe something you need to start right there. If your religion is true, I trust you'll make those changes. Father, thank you that we can practice our religion before you. You are a holy God and a merciful Father. May we bear those traits of you, God, as we practice religion in your sight.